clock, eh? Or do you still have a minute on your side?
seconds now, but we can start, Chairperson.
Okay.
Fine.
Morning, it's 9 to go.
How are you? How are you?
I'm fine, thank you, sir.
Okay, let's start, honorable members. Good morning to all of you, honorable members, our support staff, good morning, Team Treasury, led by Dr. Mambo Modise, everybody who's on the platform, good morning and you're all welcome. Today we are dealing with the Q1 2022 expenditure by departments. I think that's what National Treasury will be taking us through. And again, they'll also be taking us through Q4 2022 expenditure by agencies, SOEs, and agencies, SO and SOCs. Yeah, let's say, I think that's how we are going to go. Dr. Mampo, you have got 45 minutes maximum to take us through. But before we do that, let me check with you, Darren, do you have any apologies?
Yes, Chairperson. Received an apology on behalf of Ms. Dikgale, and then Ms. Peters indicated that she will join the meeting. However, she needs to leave early in order to address a funeral. So she will join. She has joined the meeting, but she needs to leave early.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. So those are the only apologies. Let's note them. Thank you very much, Dr. Mampo. You've got 45 minutes maximum, and you'll be going navigating through our presentations with your team. Only bring back the meeting to me after 45 minutes. Thank you so much.
Good morning, Chairperson. Good morning, honorable members. Darren, please allow me to share the presentation.
Dr. Mampo, I've already made you a co-host, so you should be able to share it.
Thanks, Darren. Okay. Chairperson, thank you so much for giving us the time to present to the committee. This quarter was a bit difficult, Chair, to be honest, to present because we tried to bring an analysis to the members so that at least you look at it in perspective. So what we have done, Chairperson, was that we had to look at what has the pattern been from the previous years. So we looked at a 5-year spending period of this underspending. What we wanted to show the committee is the trend and whether the departments that have underspent, do they show the signs of underspending? But Chairperson, this is one of the largest underspending that we have seen in the first quarter. So all in all, the projected or the underspending is 42.2 billion. This is 15% or 15.5% lower than the projected spending. And basically the underspending mainly came from transfers and subsidies as well as payments for capital assets. But of course, I will go through the detail. So what we have done here, Chairperson, to try and assist the committee is just to look at which categories tend to all underspend in the first quarter of each year. So when you look at the graph with the red bars for compensation of employees, it was only in 2019-20 where there was overspending on this category. Most of the times we see a pattern of underspending. but in goods and services, as well as payments for capital assets, there's a persistent underspending that we see in the first quarter, and then the interest and rent tend to be, it differs year on year. We also looked at the subsidies, transfers and subsidies, Chairperson. Mainly here is social grants. They contribute the most in terms of transfers and subsidies. And we see in 2 years there were significant underspending, but I will get to that. But here we just want to show the committee that these patterns of underspending in the first quarter exist, and then at least it can give a better understanding of these patterns. So Chairperson, just in summary, where we picked up the significant underspending was in public enterprises, where the recorded underspending was 17.8 billion, social development an underspending of 9.4 billion, followed by higher education at 3 billion, and then water and sanitation around 1.7 billion, agriculture 1.6, justice and constitutional development another 1.6, as well as police, we also see underspending of 1.3 billion, science and technology 1.1, trade and industry 1, health 1, basic education and corporate governance just below 1 billion each. So Chairperson, what we have then done as the team was to look at the underspending for the different departments from 2018-19 up to 2022-23. The reason why we started in 2018-19 is so that we cover years prior to COVID, so that we can have a fair assessment of the underspending. So here, when we look at the actual underspending, basically, Chairperson, what this means is that the departments each year, at the beginning of the year, they submit their estimated drawings. So we use those drawings to calculate the underspending. What we refer to as the running projection, Chairperson, is basically every month the departments are allowed to change their drawing schedule so that they can relook at whether if they underspend in the previous month, will they increase the drawing in the following month. But basically, the concept is the same. It's just that we wanted to show that even when we allow the departments to submit their drawings or basically to change their projections, they still show significant underspending. So basically, Chair and Honorable Members, for our public enterprises, the underspending was 17.8 billion, and this is mainly because of much lower than anticipated drawings from or to ESCOM or the disbursement funds to ESCOM. The second one. And the department has since finalized the contracts with banks, has since dispersed the funding. So in the second quarter, when we come back, the 9.4 billion underspending won't be as large because most of these issues that they experienced in the first quarter has already been resolved and the payments have gone through for most of the recipients. Higher education and training, 3 billion or 5.7% lower than what was projected. And basically what the department has cited as the reason for this is mainly transfers or payments of funds to some institutions, but also the outstanding claims from early minors and moderators that are not received as projected. So hopefully in the next quarter, some of these transfers would have taken place and they would have finalized the claims. Chair and Honorable Members, what we're picking up is that in general, the underspending is due to claims that are not finalized or information that is not received on time, or transfers that are not, or money that are not transferred to entities. So the nature of the understanding tends to be the same, unfortunately, over the years when we did the analysis. Water and sanitation, as I said, this was because of slower spending on the indirect regional bulk infrastructure grant, as well as the water services infrastructure grant. When we look at the underspending, unfortunately, it's 41.6% of lower than what was projected. So they projected to spend 2.4 billion, but they projected to spend 1 billion at the end. The actual spending was only 2.4 billion, meaning the underspending is 1.6%. I'm looking at agricultural land reform and rural development. The underspending there was 39.8%. They initially estimated that they're going to draw down 4.1 billion at the end quarter only. For 2.5 billion was brought down from the National Revenue Fund, and this spend is almost 40% underspending. And basically, the reasons that they cited were the delays in the payment of additional grants, but also due to outstanding office accommodation payments or the accommodation charges. Here we're looking at the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, where their underspending was 3.4% of what they said they're going to spend in this quarter. And this is mainly because there was an error in BAS, the basic accounting system, when they were processing some of these invoices. This error would be fixed when we get to the second quarter. So we don't anticipate that we're going to have this huge underspending for this department in the next quarter. South African Police Service, the delays, unfortunately, in finalizing their HR processes has resulted in the underspending. The underspending was 1.3 billion. If you look at it, 10% as the share of what they said will spend, it's only 5.4% of the underspending. So they projected that they're going to spend 24 billion, but at the end they spend 22.8 billion. We're thinking that in the next quarter, once they finalize some of these things and then do the payments, we might see some improvement there. Relative to other departments, 5.4% is not significant in the first quarter. Science and innovation is one of those departments that spend much less than anticipated, with the actual spending of just 1 billion, and they projected to spend 2 billion. This is basically an underspending of 48.9 billion. And unfortunately, this is also because of delays in late submissions of progress reports. And then the reason was that there were administrative delays. So hopefully this can be sorted out. But this is one of the departments with the significant underspending for the quarter. The DTIC, 32.7% of underspending. And this is mainly due to lower disbursements or incentives, lower than what was anticipated. And there were some transfers to agencies that could not be as planned. And this is mainly due to compliance. So 5% the overall understanding of 1 billion compared to the initial projection of 3, and they only spent about 2 billion. Health, 1 billion. This is only 6.4% of their budget. But basically, the understanding was mainly due to increase of medicine, since there hasn't been a need. We allocated the Department of Health money for vaccines, but because there hasn't been a need to get additional vaccinations because of the lower demand, then the department couldn't spend that amount. And then for basic education, chairperson, the 625 million while underspending was mainly due to accruals that haven't been finalized, and the department basically thought they would have finalized the 2021-22 across, but they couldn't. And then another reason that was cited by the department was basically lower than anticipated spending on the school infrastructure backlog grant. Then for corporate governance, Chair and honorable members, the underspending was 31.5%. The estimated projection was 1.7, but they ended up spending 1.2 billion. And this is basically because of in processing some of the invoices of claims from the community programs implementing agencies. Then, Chairperson, while we have the departments that underspend, we also have some departments that overspend. The first department that overspent was Statistics South Africa, and this is mainly due to the continuation of the census. We have been discussing this with the department that there was no allocation or additional allocation for the census, but we did give them a rollover. So this underspending, we still have to understand how the department anticipates to deal with the underspending. But if you look at their spending patterns, this is the first year where they showed significant overspending. But we are speaking to them to try and understand how we can resolve this matter of overspending on the census. And the second one that showed overspending, Chairperson, was the Department of Communications and Digital Technologies. But basically, this was because of a transfer payment that was made to the South African Post Office. And this is basically for the subsidy to cover some of the costs that are related to universal service obligations. And this the transfer was done much earlier than what was anticipated because of the problems in the post office. So they asked for an earlier withdrawal or the earlier transfer of the funds. So it's not something that we worried about because money was already budgeted for. It's just that they put down on the money earlier than anticipated. Defense Chairperson, has always been problems with the defense force, especially in terms of the compensation of employees. But as you may be aware, we have allocated 1.8 billion in this MTF for the department to deal with some of the issues of the HR rejuvenation strategy. But we're still picking up some of the overspending. But hopefully, when they finalize the HR strategy, then we will see lesser overspending in terms of the compensation of employees. And this has been unfortunately with the department since 2018-19, but hopefully by the time they finish the implementation of their HR strategy, and then there won't be significant overspending. Department of Employment and Labor, the overspending was 106 million, which represents 8%, and this was mainly due to the payment that was made to GTEC in response to the Presidential Youth Employment Intervention Phase 3. The drawing schedule didn't include this amount for the first quarter, but Chair, when we come back in the second quarter, there won't be the overspending, so we're not too worried about the overspending. So in terms of the departments where there's overspending and we are worried about that, that would be Statistics SA. And then we are working with the Department of the Defense Force so that they can implement their rejuvenation strategy. And then hopefully by doing that and with the savings that they're going to realize after they implement the strategy, then there won't be the overspending. And in terms of the departments that have underspent, the public enterprises and social development, we're not too worried about them, Chairperson, because it means that there has been some improvements in ESCOM. That's why they have brought down all the money that was allocated for them, and the issues in social development have been fixed. In the second quarter, when we come back, we won't see such high underspending. But for the other departments, we have to monitor them closely. Then Chairperson and honorable members, these are just some of the public entities that we look at. I'll just go quickly and highlight the ones where we worried about them in terms of the deficits that they may have or in terms of the surpluses. But for the compensation fund, they collected more than what was anticipated in terms of the interest, as well as some of the penalties, fines, and forfeits, but they also spent quite less than what they thought they would spend. Therefore, they resulted in a surplus for the year of 5 billion. I'm looking at Legal Aid South Africa, not much here. Chairperson, they spend, they receive more taxes. Their spending was aligned to their projection. So if you look at the surplus deficit, it's a surplus of 133 million. But this is we're not worried about this entity, of course. The employment, the National Employment Fund, they received basically much more than what they anticipated, and this was mainly through the loans as well as other receipts. Totaling 2 billion and they estimated for 1 million. If you look at the surplus then, as a result, it was 1.8 billion. So we're not worried about the entity because they're registering surpluses. National Health Laboratory Services, Chairperson, even here, they are spending and their income was aligned. The marginal deficit of 153 million, we're not too worried about it, and we think the entity can deal with some of this. And then the National Research Foundation, Chairperson, we see a surplus of 151 million, and this was because they spent a bit than what was anticipated, but also received revenue that was more than anticipated only in the non-tax revenue. But of course, transfers received were 269 million less than what they anticipated. But we're not so worried about their book because of the surplus that was registered. The National Skills Fund, same thing, Chairperson, not to worry because the entity, when it closed the year, it had a deficit of 409, but this is mainly because of the total payments that were higher than anticipated for the transfers and subsidies. But the entity is still under good financial position, so we're not too worried. And then the National Student Financial Aid Scheme, Chairperson, at the end, the entity had a surplus of 5.7 billion, and this was mainly due to lesser transfers than they anticipated. So they expected that they will transfer 47.6 at the end of the fourth quarter. They only transferred 42.045 billion, and that resulted, of course, in a surplus of 5.7 billion mainly. And then the South African Rail Agency, the Passenger Rail Agency of South Africa, PRASA, we're still seeing Chairperson significant underspending in terms of the capital assets. By the fourth quarter, they expect to spend 80 billion, but eventually spent only 6 billion. And this resulted mainly into, or this was the category that resulted mainly into their surplus of 14 billion for the year. Road Accident Fund, Chair, there was a surplus of 11.8 billion, but this was mainly due to, one, a combination of higher transfers received. Estimate was 43.8 billion, but they ended up getting 47 billion. And then they also paid less than what they anticipated. The expected payments were 69 billion, but year to date, or for the full year of 2021-22, the payments were only 51 billion. And then as a result, they have a surplus of 11.8 billion. National Parks, we're not worried about this entity, Chairperson. Their expected revenue and expenditure were generally aligned to what they expected or what they anticipated. SARS, Chairperson, the transfers received, of course, they got what they expected, They did receive some of the revenue from non-tax receipts, but that was only around 82 million. And then they spent less than what they said they were going to spend for both the current payments as well as the payments for assets. So at the end of the year, SARS showed a surplus of just below a billion, of 982 million. And then SANRAL chairperson, issues of SANRAL unfortunately haven't been resolved, but basically they just spent more than what they anticipated in terms of the payments for capital assets. And then at the end, they registered a deficit of 1.3 billion. Chairperson SASA, we're not worried about the entity. They receive the transfers, but also they spend according to expectations. So they have a surplus of 704 million. And then SA Tourism is another entity, chairperson, that we're not worried about. Their spending is aligned to revenue, and we haven't got anything that requires the attention of the committee. And lastly, the Unemployment Insurance Fund, where basically they receive more revenue than what is anticipated, but they also paid more than expected because their payments were 25 billion compared to the 20 billion that was estimated, but because of the higher collections or higher transfers received, their surplus was 7.3 billion at the end of the 2021-22 fiscal year. Chairperson, I'm just going to ask Ulrika quickly to go through the disaster funding. We thought it would be beneficial for us to bring this to the committee so that you're also aware of the spending. We are trying, Chairperson, to bring to amend the report so that we can show the committee when we submit the report to the disaster funding. So we're working with the departments just to make sure they classify the disaster spending correctly. But for now, we thought let's add a few slides so that we give you the details of the spending year to date for the disaster funding. Ulrika, please go ahead.
Thank you, honorable members. This slide basically shows that we have either reprioritized or allocated 5.4 billion rand in funding for the response to the April and May floods. The largest share of reprioritization and allocations went to KZN. We've also seen some reprioritizations across different grants. In the most notable would be in human settlements, on the human settlements development grant, and on the informal settlements updating partnership grant. Just to clarify, of the billion rand immediate response grants that we have in the budget, 674 million of that has been allocated, mostly to KZN, but we have seen some small allocations made to the East Cape. Next slide, please. And then just in response to what has been allocated, this is how much has been spent that departments report on. Most notable would be in vote 33 on human settlements. We had allocated the full 350 million rand on the grant, on the provincial emergency housing grant, of which 140 million rand was already transferred. That's the first tranche. Once the province spends 80% of that grant, the department will process the second trust payment of the balance of that amount. We do have other allocation conversions of grants that we are working on right now. This relates to the provincial emergency housing grant that has been exhausted. So the Division of Revenue Act allows us to move money from the municipal emergency housing grant, and similarly we're doing the same on the municipal disaster response grant, where we are converting funds from the municipal, or from the provincial disaster response grant to the municipal disaster response grant. So in total, of the money that we have has been allocated, national and provincial departments have spent just under 360 million rand. Next slide, please, Mampo. This slide, honorable members, just shows further expenditure around the disaster response grant. So, for example, on the municipal disaster response grant, this would be what the Department of Cooperative Governance has transferred to municipalities in the Eastern Cape and in KZN, and the amount for water and sanitation relates to the Water Services Infrastructure Grant for water tankering in municipalities, both in the Eastern Cape and in KZN. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chairperson. Ravesh, you next.
Okay, thank you, Chairperson. Honourable members, I'm going to basically, the team are going to basically take you through those fees, which is ESCOM, Post Office, SASRIA, SAA, AXA, and also Land Bank. Let me just put up the presentation. I think, Darren, I don't have sharing rights. If you can allow me to share, thanks. Darren, and I'll just hand over through to Jeff to take us through to ESCOM. Jeff?
Thank you, Ravesh. Good morning, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. In relation to ESCOM, Honorable Members, ESCOM still continues to struggle with its debt burden that is sitting on its balance sheet and its inability to service its debt and has to rely on the fiscals for support in order to meet its obligations. We've seen in the quarter that the debt has increased to about 413 billion. But on the other side, the revenue slightly increased, but largely on the increase in tariff that came into effect on the 1st of April for ESCOM's customers, as the municipal customer comes into effect on the 1st of July. We've also noted that ESCOM, in terms of guarantees, ESCOM continues to rely, hence the debt has increased. The next slide, Ravesh. So in the next slide, what also we picked up is, honorable members will be aware of this, that ESCOM has been relying heavily on the usage of diesel at stations, which in the quarter alone have incurred about $4 billion. This is extremely worrying because there's a limit that the regulator allows the entity to use these diesel generators. But because of the poor performance of its fleet, ESCOM has to rely on these stations. And this is largely due to the maintenance that they have been raising as an issue, as well as the commissioning of the new power stations. But also, this has actually translated, their poor performance has actually translated in the decrease in the energy availability factor. This is largely a measure of what is available in the grid. And by reducing or the reduction to about 59%, it therefore demonstrates that ESCOM's fleet is continuing to struggle. Normally, you would want to see this increasing so that it then enables the entity to then have efficient capacity in the grid, but this is not the case in this instance. And this is largely attributed to the unplanned losses that they are incurring. And as a result, we've seen huge amount of rolling load shedding being implemented to the extent that at some stage we also experience load shedding stage 6 for 3 days, which is a serious worry. So the continued usage of the diesel generators is quite one in this instance. The next slide, Robert. So in the next one is it's in relation to the equity conditions that are attached to the allocations that we provide. As common in this instance in the quarter, they are still keeping up and they are meeting all the conditions. However, as we've indicated, the performance is actually not reflecting any improvement so far. The next one, Ravesh. So in this slide, what is just reporting on is that the regulator, after being instructed by the High Court to adjudicate ESCOM's application in terms of the multi-year price determination that ESCOM has applied for, the regulator did as instructed, and for this current financial year, they have allocated ESCOM an increase in line with the multi-year price determination. And there's also an agreement between the regulator and NGG that for the next year, we'll still continue to adjudicate based on the multi-year price determination methodology. However, the regulator is currently consulting and undertaking public hearings just to on the proposed principles of the new methodology that they want to propose, that they want to implement, so that in future they can adjudicate ESCOM as well as the municipalities tariff application based on this new method. But it is still work in progress, something that the regulator is still working on. On the other side, the entity has made some progress in relation to the unbundling. We've seen the establishment of the new National Transmission Company of South Africa, which will be responsible for the transmission side. That has been established. We've also received both the Department of Public Prices and National Treasury, the PPMA applications that we've approved for the establishment. We are busy now with the operationalization, and ESCOM is also busy engaging its lenders for the transfer of assets into this new subsidiary of the entity. On the other side, the GMRE is also busy with its consultation and approval process for the new ERA or electricity regulation bill, which will give a sense of the state of the electricity sector will be in future. That's all, Ravesh. Thank you, honorable members.
Jeff, let's move on to post office.
Thanks, Ravesh. This slide is not moving on. So for post office, what you see is that the entity continues to struggle through all the quarters, and then in quarter one, the persistence of that financial struggle because of the non-performing revenues of the entity. So in quarter one, the performance has been as well, where we've seen only about 46% of its targets being met, key performance indicators to date. Although post office has finalized its new strategy together with the sales department, DCDT, this strategy is you know, it's, I want to say it's highly flawed because it's highly premised on it, the post office receiving funding from government as applications. And then during quarter one, we've also seen a further decline in a number of employees that have left the entity. So there's more people that have left the entity, and this is attributed to a lot of other reasons, but it's basically ranging from resignations, demises, and some dismissals and end of contracts to contract employees. However, we want to highlight that the organization needs to restructure. It's currently being finalized, and the reduction of employees is in line with what they planned in the post office strategy of tomorrow. Next slide, Arvis. Financially, the SAPO continues to be severely constrained on its cash flow. In the first quarter, we've seen a further deterioration of its cash flows. It's reported in the first quarter the net loss position of 608 million. And this is a little bit better than what they had budgeted for. But if you compare it to prior year, then it's something like 8% worse than it was in the previous year, the same quarter. And then revenues of 628 were reported in the first quarter, which is 46% below its budget, and a decrease by prior year by further 25%. Expenses also continue to outstrip its revenues, further escalating its financial challenges and weakening the continuation of the weak performance of the entity. So the messaging is that they are currently commercially insolvent, as it has negative equity of 4.6 billion. And then if there's also an additional accumulated losses that have been added to by some specific payments that post office is not being able to do. And then we sort of put a summary together of what's happening in the post elections. They continue to face liquidity challenges, and it doesn't seem to have plans to uplift their commercial revenues or uphold its revenue sustainability. And this is despite the previously receiving funding from the community turnaround plans. It's also struggling now in quarter one reported that they're struggling to make payment for salaries to its employees. And they've also, generally, we're seeing that in the first quarter, when you take it into account, they're actually failing to implement this very strategy that is in place that they require funding for. And then the financial situation at the end of quarter cast a significant doubt on the ability of support to be viewed as a going concern because of its insolvency. And then there's need for support to implement quick win initiatives. These are mainly revenue initiatives and some of its partnerships initiatives that they have outlined in the strategy, so they can get out of the financial cash flow problems that they're in. I think that's the last point on my part. Thanks, Ravish.
Thanks, George. Let's move on to Sasria Surufelo.
Thanks, Ravish. Morning, honorable members and our colleagues on the line. Honorable members will recall that as a result of the July unrest in 2021, Sasria was recapitalized with 22 billion, as it had insufficient capital reserves. So the equity injection assisted Sasria to pop up its solvency cover ratio
Miss Muratori.
Yes, Chairperson.
I forgot to say this. We always try and insist that please be on the screen. Unmute your video.
Okay. Apologies. Give me a second. Is it unmuted now?
Not yet.
Not yet. You can't see me. Can you see me now?
We can see you now. Thank you.
All right. No, I.
We just want to make sure that we're not talking to the robot or listening to the robot. Okay.
And Chair, we also don't want any John Sinners.
Okay, continue.
All right. So the solvency cover ratio is now at 100%, which is above the Prudential Authority minimum. So now Sasria is solvent, so N is a going concern. So going forward, Sasria is working on other initiatives to try to build up its capital reserve over and above the allocation that government has provided, like reviewing its distribution channels and introducing new products which may require legislative amendment. So as at 30 June 2022, Sasria has paid 25 billion of the claims that it had received, with 7 billion, which is still outstanding. The outstanding claims are those that the claimants or the clients still need to provide information so that Sasria can settle those claims. In the meantime, Sasria has reinvested the funds for those expected claims. As I was indicating, so Sasria had estimated its CSIR ratio would now be at 117% by June 2022, and it has projected to achieve a solvency capital ratio of 195% for March 2023 with all its initiatives implemented. So the National Treasury continues to monitor the progress that Sasria has made with regards to the settlement of the claims through the reports as submitted by the entity and engagements. Thank you, honorable members.
Okay, thanks, Lufelo. Let's move on to SAA and EXA, which will be Nolwazi Tlungwane.
Good morning, colleagues. National Treasury was requested to provide quarterly updates to Parliament on the utilization of the 2.7 billion allocation made to the subsidiaries of South African Airways. The 2.7 billion formed part of the 10.5 billion that was made available to SAA during the 2020 MTBPS for the implementation of the business rescue plan. However, the 10.5 billion was exclusively earmarked for the business rescue process and therefore could not be transferred to the SAA subsidiaries because they were not in business rescue. So the Special Appropriation Act made adjustments to allow for the 2.7 billion to be transferred to the SAA subsidiaries. The Special Appropriation Act provided for the following funding per subsidiary: SAA Technical, 1.663 billion, Mango, 819 million, and HDFs, 218 million. SAA exited business rescue in April 2021, and they resumed operations in September 2021. Mango was placed under business rescue in August 2021, and they published the business rescue plan in October 2021. So the full 819 million that was allocated to Mango has been transferred and utilized as follows. 100 million was used for the payment of salaries and to cover the cost of developing the business rescue plan. 320 million was used for VSCs and the restructuring costs. And the remaining 399 million was transferred in March 2021 for the restructuring of the airline. So Mango remains under business rescue and has not resumed operations. SAA Technical, so the full 1.663 billion allocated to SAA Technical was transferred to the entity and has been utilized as follows. 704 million was used to pay employee salaries, 79 million was used for the purchase of spares, and 879 million was used for the completion of the restructuring process and a working capital for the business. So SAA Technical continues to incur losses. However, the entity has indicated that it aims to diversify its revenue streams through leveraging its existing capabilities. So HFs, the full 218 million has been transferred to HFs and has been utilized as follows. 107 million was used for employee salaries for the period April 2020 to July 2021. And 111 million was used for restructuring of the business. So the company's net loss for the month ended 31 July 2022 was 1.5 million, which was below budget. So the entity reported a negative EBITDA of 1.2 million against a budget of 1.9 million. And SHF has reported that one of its potential customers has put a catering tender on hold. And this is expected to have negative impact on the company's operations and profitability going forward. Thank you. So on the airport company, so AXA was supported by government through the purchase of preference shares in 2021, which amounted to 2.3 billion. So AXA's revenue was impacted by travel restrictions and the grounding of the airlines, and the passenger volumes are only expected to recover to pre-pandemic levels in 2026-2027. So AXA is expected to report a loss of approximately 1.47 billion in 2021-2022, which is an improvement from the loss of 2.56 billion in 2020-2021. No additional fiscal support will be required, and AXA is expected to start generating profits in 2023-24. Thank you.
So was it? And lastly, Land Bank, Lufthansa.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, everyone. I'm not sure if you can hear me or my video. Let me get my video. All right. Chair, can you hear me? Can you see me? Because I've tried.
A signal defense.
And in bone, I don't know whether the problem is my, because from my side, let me make sure that everything is fine. From my side, my video is on and my, I've unmuted. I'm not sure whether it's the problem is my computer or what, but I've.
I'm sure it's your computer. Continue then, defense.
Okay, thanks, Chair. I'm hoping that the picture will come as I speak. It's a land bank, Chair. The most difficult institution to really get to find solution to this. There's been very little movement with regards to the land bank, since we know that the land bank are currently doing basically negotiating with the lenders, and there's basically little business that land bank is currently doing, because like I explained in the last meeting, technically the land bank is the books of the land bank are owned by the, and in fact the debt book or the loan book of the land bank is owned by the lenders, and they seem to dictate the terms on how this book can actually be utilized. And as such, it becomes very difficult for land bank to do business. The negotiations that I have been in with the lenders are basically putting a very strain on the whole performance of the land bank, I suppose even including National Treasury officials, because there have been unending negotiations trying to persuade them to fully support the land bank. Yes, they have, because they have not called on the debt and they have not actually taken land bank to court so far, but we feel that they can actually do more. Currently, the amount that land that you remember the 7 billion recap that land bank is supposed to receive. It's supposed to receive six billion of that amount in this financial year, which we hope it will still receive if it meets all the conditions that we have actually set for them, which is also basically asking them to conclude on these negotiations so that they can actually fully support the land bank. But out of the 7 billion, 100 billion has already been paid to World Bank in the form of a call and a guarantee, which happens sometimes in August. So the amount that needs to flow to the land bank for this financial year is 6.9 billion. And the remainder of 1 billion will actually fall in the 2023-2024. The deadline set by the land bank and the negotiation, in fact, it's the land bank, can be the lenders, because they seem to always crash this deadline every time we said it. Remember, in the last report that we made, we said the deadline was supposed to have been sometimes in the end of the financial year, and then they requested an extension, which have been pushed to the end of September. This coming month. While we are hopeful, Chair, that this negotiation will somehow reach finality, and then we have a situation where we conclude and land banks start doing business, and then we can transfer the money to the lenders. There are also some other indications that do not give us some hope with regard to how these lenders and how this negotiation have been going. Now, some of the few things that I've mentioned here have the ones that makes us to feel that we may not even win this battle. A large portion, the lenders say they want a large portion of the 7 billion to be given to them for payment of debt. Basically, they want the entire money to be given to them. Lenders want surety from government that they will not incur any losses on their investment to the land bank. However, the government is unable to provide this surety, as only 1.3 of the land bank's total debt is guaranteed. Only 1.3 out of the total debt that is currently sitting at about 28 billion. Remember, this debt when we started the negotiation was at about 40 billion. It's going down. And I guess if one can get, as soon as another payment is made, then this number is going to reduce. I think Land Bank spoke about it, it's going to reduce to about 22-23 billion before the end of this financial year. Now the lenders also, there was a work that was done by an Estonia, which lenders had actually requested. They want the valuation of the loan book to check the true quality of that loan book. When that report came, some of the lenders had some views on it and they want further work to be done on that. And that on its own, it basically makes the whole process to delay. There's also a core group of lenders consisting of about seven lenders who have decided to appoint PwC as their financial advisor. And I guess whatever PwC is advising on them makes them to act on some of the things. And as such, we find ourselves in a situation where some of this core group of lenders do not agree with a number of things that we negotiate on a daily basis. Hence, I'm saying that there's a high risk that the deadline for September may not be met. But we continue hoping that we'll be able to do that. Last week, we had a long meeting, on half-day meeting with the lenders, our DDG, together with Land Bank. We had a long half-day meeting with the Land Bank, trying to find out what is it that we as National Treasury can do to support them. But here's the biggest challenge. One of the biggest challenges that the lenders want is a guarantee that in the event that and there is a loss, National Treasury must actually provide them with the guarantee. Now, because according to the agreement, there's a five-year amortizing note, which promises that Land Bank will keep on paying these lenders. But when you look at it, there's going to be what we call a tail risk or what you call a credit risk at the end. Now, the Land Bank estimated that credit risk to about 7 billion, which will have to be paid in 2027. Now, lenders are saying they are not willing to take that risk of losing about 7 billion. Now, they want government to provide them with a guarantee that after 7 billion, government will give them. After five years, government will give them that 7 billion from the fiscals, which is something that we are still not trying to negotiate. Because if you look at that, I'm not sure Mampo would want to share the story, because it basically says that after 7 years, we'll recapitalize Land Bank with 7 billion. But that money is not going to be for agriculture. It's going to go directly to the books of the lenders. So Land Bank will not have money to actually do the business. So we are sitting with a situation on what is it that we can assure the lenders that we are fully supportive of the Land Bank, but at the same time, we don't want to take a stance that says National Treasury will give Land Bank 7 billion, that Land Bank will pass to the lenders in five years. That on its own basically gives us a challenge. And based on what I just said, we are thinking that lenders just towards the end of this month, they will tell us that they don't agree to this liability solution. Now the question is, what will the lenders do? Will they actually try to liquidate the bank, try to find another way? We don't know what they actually will actually do if we don't find to agree with them in terms of how do we deal with this, with the risk. But what we're trying to do now, hence you see the delay, is to protect the current 7 billion. And because if you throw it into the bank now, by any chance you throw it into the bank, it automatically falls into the hands of the lenders. And some of the lenders may just grab that money and run. And then we have the Land Bank that has no lenders and also does not have money, because that money would actually been lost. So our efforts to protect the bank makes it even more stressful for some of us, because we don't even know what is it that we have to say to the lenders that will make them happy. Thanks, Chair. I'll continue with that. Ravesh? I'm fine. I don't want to talk to the numbers, because the numbers of the Land Bank do not actually give us a story that makes us happy, because Land Bank is not doing business. The NPLs are increasing on a daily basis and everything. So that's why we want to conclude this liability solution, so that Land Bank can start doing business and we see the numbers becoming better and better every day. Thanks, Chair.
Yeah, thanks, FNZ. Thanks, thanks, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. That concludes from ALM. Thank you.
Dr. Mampo?
Thank you, Chair. That's it.
Honorable Members, thank you very much to Team Treasury with their presentations. Thank you very much. Honorable Members, you know how we do it. Can I have indications of all members who would like to have a bite on the presentation?
Matafa. Chair, it's Honorable Sarupan, I'd like a bite.
Honorable Matafa, Honorable Sarupan. I'm listening, Honorable Members.
Mlenzana.
Honorable Mlenzana.
Kaiso.
Honorable Kaiso. Another member. Honorable Kwankwa, still there? Honorable Mare.
Yes.
Do you want to have a bite?
Yes.
Honorable Mare. Any other oral member? Okay. Let's start with the Honorable Matafa. Honorable Matafa.
Good morning, Chairperson. Good morning, Dr. Mampo and the team, honorable members. Thank you, Chair, for the opportunity to engage the presentation. But let me also thank Dr. Mampo and the team for the brilliant presentation. Chair, I just have a few questions that I would like to pose for clarity. The first one is on the issue of the Border Management Authority that has been recently announced in a form of a national public entity in terms of Schedule 3A of the Public Finance Management Act. I'm just interested to find out, considering the current constraints and the fiscal policy objectives of the country, what is the proposed funding model for this particular new entity? And has there been any engagement between National Treasury and the department or the BMA to ensure that this entity is adequately funded so that it can fulfill its mandate as anticipated? Chair, the second point is on one issue that is always burning for this committee, the issue of vacancies that are not filled by the department. I'm asking, Chair, considering the difficulties that are faced by Statistics SA and also the public works and infrastructure, because there we see persistent slow-moving expenditure by the Department of Public Works and Infrastructure. We think that it's owed to poor project management, and for us it remains a cause for concern. So why we're raising the issue of vacancies is that in most cases where departments are failing in their mandate, particularly as it relates to spending, we are always informed of lack of capacity within the department. However, it is worrying that we will always hear of lack of capacities, but critical vacancies remains open and remains unfilled. So I'm just interested to find out what are the reasons that we have so many unfunded vacancies, or funded vacancies rather, in the Public Works Department, and what are action plans that have been put in place to ensure that these vacancies are filled? Chair, on the same issue of public works and infrastructure, with regard to the underspending on the expanded public works program, what is it that impedes the department from obtaining project lists during the budget planning process and finalizing signed agreements before the beginning of the fiscal year in order to expedite spending on the EPWP conditional grant? Because from where we are sitting, we believe that when you have a list, it guides you in terms of your spending expectations and also the tracking of that particular expenditures. We also note slow moving spending, Chair, in the infrastructure grant by the Department of Higher Education and Training, which for us is a concern. And as the lack of access to affordable student accommodation is a major stumbling block to expanding access to tertiary education. Considering this poor infrastructure delivery performance by the Department of Public Works, we need to answer certain questions about the implications of the Department of Higher Education and Training building its internal capacity to deliver on infrastructure, and how it can utilize lessons learned by the Department of Basic Education in using implementing agents to expedite delivery on student accommodation. We just need to find out from Treasury, is it something feasible to consider given these two issues that we are raising, that maybe some of these functions are devolved to the affected departments? And the last point, Chair, equally, it's on the slow moving spending on conditional grants by the Department of Agriculture, Land Reform and Rural Development, which again is a cause of concern. Basically, all underspending for all departments across the spectrum is a concern. In this particular instance, many smallholder and emerging farmers are faced with rising input costs that could potentially push them out of the sector. I think we need an explanation, Chair, as to why accounting officers, the accounting officer in this particular case, did not approve business plans during the budget planning process in order to expedite the transfer of grants to provinces. And I think it's also important, Chair, that we raise the issue of the projected underspending of 1.6 billion by the Department of Water and Sanitation. As transfers to Umgeni Water were not affected due to non-submission of the required project documentation. Considering that yearly, KZN experiences protests related to the delivery of water services, there needs to be an urgent and greater accountability where accounting authorities or officers unnecessarily delay spending. So we just wanted to make that point, Chair. But once again, thank you very much. The presentation is very helpful, and thank you for the opportunity to engage. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Matafa. Honourable Sarupen, please come in.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Chair, let me thank National Treasury for the presentation as well. It was very informative. Chair, I have several questions. I'm going to start where we finished off with, which is the land bank. And when we first were approached by this committee for a bailout for the land bank, and we went through the process, the public participation, et cetera, the matter relating to the conduct of potential creditors was not raised, and such a bailout was then approved. Now we get told it's in a suspense account, and there are all of these issues, and so on. In fact, we were told that the creditors at the time would be in favor of the approach that was proposed by National Treasury then, and now we're getting a completely different version of events. So what I would like to understand, firstly, is what would be the consequences of the creditors not being repaid? Because when one participates in an open market and gives loans, if you're a private company and you can loan anything, whether it's a government entity, a private individual, you take a bet that that person or that entity is going to be able to pay its loan back or not, which is why you charge interest. And the reality is that when that loan fails, when your bet has failed, you then forfeit all of that and you take whatever you can get, which is whatever amounts of rands on, whatever amounts of cents in the rand that is available. And would it not make more sense then for the state to allow land bank to go into liquidation and create a completely new entity to fulfill that function? Are we committed to this entity just because of its historical role, or can we not create a completely new one and demonstrate to markets that when you operate in free markets, whether it's the government or the private sector, when you gamble and when you give loans to entities that are failing, whether it is a state or private institution, that you have gambled and lost, and that's basically how the entire loan system works. they need good loans, but the bad loans that they give, despite their due diligence, needs to have consequences for them and not just for the state. So that's my first question with regards to the land bank. Then my second question, Chair, is with regards to the ESCOM situation, the reasons that were given, and so on. We see this year in and year out. But the other issue with ESCOM, of course, is that they are given 20 billion rand a year from the fiscus, as we know, on their bailouts, and they were given bailouts for the last three consecutive years. What we haven't seen in a while, Chair, is the conditions imposed by the minister for those bailouts to ESCOM, as well as other entities, but particularly to ESCOM, and the nature of compliance with those particular bailouts. So I'd like to know what the conditions have been imposed in the current financial year for the 20 billion rand that they've gotten this year, and what their compliance is, because this is the worst year on record for load shedding. So it would be curious to see if there is anything around improvement in performance and uptime and so on, related to the bailouts that ESCOM has continuously got. Then with regards to Mango, I think that we need to ask the question, is good money being thrown after bad, or was good money thrown after bad with Mango? Because operations have not resumed. It's been since March 2021 that Mango stopped operating. It's now August 2022. And we are seeing nothing of any potential restart of Mango. And we are not seeing anything about potential privatization of Mango or any sort of future. So what is going on? Was there good money after bad? And what were the conditions imposed onto Mango to get its bailout? I would like some answers around that. I also would like to know if the other entities, SA Technical and SA Airshifts, are now fully functioning and profitable, and what conditions were imposed onto those entities. And then, Chair, just with regards to the Department of Water and Sanitation and the slow spending in the first quarter, we know that the department makes a lot of money available to various municipalities, particularly those in drought-stricken parts of the Eastern Cape. I'd like to get a sense of what is the status of the spending in those particular areas, like Nelson Mandela Bay and surrounds, and if that is the cause of slow spending for the Department of Water and Sanitation. And if so, what measures National Treasury is taking to engage those municipalities to make sure that where towns have run out of water, that there is actually any work going on with the money that has been released by national government to help them alleviate that situation. Chair, there are lots of members with questions, so I don't want to take them all, so I will yield at this time. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Honorable Sarupen. Honorable Lenzana is coming.
Good morning, Chairperson, and honorable members, Dr. Mampo and Tim. Good morning. Chairperson, let me also welcome this presentation by Tim Treasurer. Dr. Mampo, I have decided to change the approach now to my questions, because the report, Chairperson, if you notice, it's a bit consistent. There's few changes, particularly when you're talking understanding. Now, my question to Team Treasury would be, Chairperson, I know it may sound controversial. Dr. Mampo, is there no information that is hidden from us, particularly from your working relations? Is there no undermining of one office by the other? I'm asking this, Chairperson, because we have been advising, and I believe that Team Treasury actually acceded to our advice that there be, beyond just quarterly and monthly monitoring, that there could even be weekly monitoring as part of in-year monitoring. But it doesn't look like there is any change. Hence, I want to check, and Dr. Mampo, if she could be honest to us, as to, are the officials that are deployed by Team Treasury to these various departments of help to such departments, or aren't they undermined? The second one, Chair, would be on disaster and floods, just to check, Dr. Mampo and your team, what informed your allocation to provinces? Were you guided by a particular report which was brought in from, say, municipalities or what? Or was there some sucking or what? Then also coupled with that would be, is Team Treasury able to follow up on the allocated funds, avoiding a situation where a person will want more because of necessity and urgency? We see ourselves pumping in money in the form of trying to deal with disaster, only to find that at the end of the day, that money will end up falling into this trap of being underspent, which means we would have just allocated money for nothing. The third, which I think is the last one, Chairperson, for me, would be on your working relations, Dr. Mampo and Team Treasury, with the Auditor General of South Africa, and of course, DME, particularly that we had asked UACFA to conduct real-time audits. Now, are you in talking terms as the three entities, particularly UACFA? Because the last one that I would be interested in would be, how is Auditor General of South Africa supported to conduct its audit function, particularly in the sense that now I am talking of us as Parliament having asked to AXA to go an extra mile. Do we have specific funding for such, or it is business as usual for AXA, where AXA would work and expect auditors to pay back, and if auditors don't pay, then it means they would remain suffering. Thanks, Jefferson. Jefferson, thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Lenzana. Thank you very much. That was muted. Honorable Kaiso, please come in.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair, and thank you, Dr. Mampo and your team for this presentation, detailed presentation, and then Chair, I just want to, first, before I go to my question, to, I think as a committee, we need to note that improvement in as far as, you know, the performance of UIF and the SA Tourism and SASA. I think that picture, at least, it has become very much more, you know, should be appreciated in as far as their performance is concerned up to so far. But I think, Chair, Honorable Chair, what we need to, we must do now, because we have been repeating some of these questions over a period when it comes to underspending. I think we need to draw a line now as a committee. The issue of, you know, filling fully funded vacant positions or posts, it is a story that we have to draw the line on the sand, and with a particular deadline for those affected departments, including the public works. We need to draw a line or a deadline. This is where it ends, after which definitely we have to take the matter now to the, we can't be repeating some of these issues repeatedly without an end now, because this has become very serious, because it results into what we now call a issue which is then goes to compensation of employees, of which at a later stage we encounter what we call a dispute of in the wages, because there are reasons that people can advance very easy, because this matter is not being handled quite properly, it invites more troubles instead of resolving troubles. So we must put a deadline, we must draw a line to Chairperson on this matter that within a fixed period of months, this matter which affects full vacant position, funded positions of the departments must have been addressed so that when we meet with these committees, with these departments, that there is a progress, right? Now, let me come to the Department of Higher Education and Higher Education and Training. The 3 billion payment of non-payment of grants totaling around 3 billion rands. I think this it's really not acceptable, Honorable Chair, that we see this situation. I can't imagine what is happening with, for instance, I just want to make an example. There is a new community college, for instance, in Mangaung in Free State, which has been built in the bushes near the graves. It is never completed for so many years. It is just staying there in the bushes. You don't know what is the reasons. Whilst we cry, crying around the issue which the Statistics South Africa service says for the first quarter of 2022, 46.3% of young people between the ages of 14 and 34 years were not in the employment, education or training. So the Financial Fiscal Commission also says, it pointed out that the expanded public works is an essential pathway of unemployed youth to access training and system or employment support programs. Underspending undermines the government's intervention to address the significant challenges of high youth unemployment in the country. Yes, there is a college which is just standing there in the bushes near the grave. It is not being completed. And that's infrastructure, part of the infrastructure. So wholly, you see how this is being undermined by the department. So I don't know. We definitely have to draw a line now as a committee around this some of these departments which are really undermining the initiatives of the government to achieve this, to address the issue of unemployment. Now, I want to also, we definitely also have to draw a line around the issue on the basic education program with around infrastructure, especially the school's infrastructure, whereby the department, instead of actually complying to remove or to resolve to address the backlogs in as far as, you know, pit latrine, toilets and many other, you know, poor infrastructure. No, it actually come up with mechanism to undermine what we are trying to address. I think I've got a very serious problem with that, with what is happening now in as far as that is concerned. So the department has to move with speed to address that issue that we have raised as a committee with a clear deadlines, not to remove the deadlines. The deadlines are right. They must ensure that the problems are being resolved. Now, lastly, Chair, it's on the issue of ESCOM. I think ESCOM repeatedly we've made reference to the challenges that are facing ESCOM, and it seems to have now, you know, reached alarming proportions with regard to what the report is saying here, that there isn't much that is improving with regard to ESCOM, even if they have tried to report, you know, as required by Treasury, but there isn't much that is actually coming out. Is that it has actually become a dead horse. So I think this matter we definitely have to, because there are so many interventions that have been, you know, put such that ESCOM is able to perform, because Remember, the economic recovery program is really based on the performance of Eskom itself. Now, in the presence of these challenges that are overwhelming in Eskom, it makes every economic life of the country very difficult. So I think there has to be, you know, redoubling of efforts to make sure that now the issue of Eskom and energy is, you know, finally find its way to resolve, Chairperson. And let me, yeah, lastly, on Treasury, I think we must raise this. While Treasury, especially when it comes to underspending, Treasury disputes the findings of the Auditor General. The fact that remains that in the 2019-20 financial year, the department made payments of 67 million for which no services were received on technical support and maintenance for the integrated financial management system. What remedial steps has Treasury taken to stop fruitless and wasteful expenditure on the IFMS project? I just want to know that, Dr. Mampo, has any disciplinary measures been taken against anybody, any person with regard to that? Has Treasury conducted an assessment of expenditure, efficiency, and value for money on spending to date on this project? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Taiso. Honorable Mare.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to start first with Stats SA. The overspend, we all know, was due to the extension of the census for 3 times that I was know about, because workers wasn't paid on time in the first round, and then they left some of them, and they have to train more people, and then again not paid on time again, and they left again some of them, and then it's the third time extension. But I just want to say, and it's important to have a very well organized census for South Africa, because a lot depends on allocation of funds according to the census outcome. You have an indication at what stage we will more or less have a final report on the outcome of census of 2022. And then secondly, to me, to the infrastructure spending. By the 30th of September, we will be mid-year of this financial year. And I understand normally with all contracts that have to be concluded and that the capitals normally pick up as from the second term of this financial year. It is of great concern if infrastructure that has been budgeted for is not actually spending, and I think it's specific in municipalities where it is essential for the grants that have been allocated to them. And as far as water sanitation is concerned, there any update maybe they have on the completion and building of extension of the wall incline William Dam here in the Western Cape? And yes, I think overall, I don't want to say something about the land bank. I think my colleague already addressed it, but I'm a positive person, but I up on the land bank. I think it's all about the debt is too high and the actual management addresses is not in place. So thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mare. Before I come in, is there any other member would like to come in who has left something out? Members? Okay, let's see then. Let me come in. Let me join our members for the presentation from Team Treasury. I think it's the story of underspending, and it's general comment that I will make, that let's not be too willing to, Dr. Maso, to set explanation of variances in the first court, because what happens, this will be carried through before we know why the last court and this picture continues. That's a general comment to make. But another question would be, for me, this big variances, whatever explanation that is being given, by the way, these are the very same departments who present these budgets and say, by the first quarter, we would have spent so much, second quarter, third quarter, fourth quarter. But first quarter comes, then you've got 101 reasons why this has happened. What do you think, what would be your comment about about the budgeting skills in departments? You see, if you are going to have a variance of 40%, it's as good as not having that, right? When you have an actual which is 40% of the mark, it's a lot about the budgeting skill. But I just want to get from Treasury, what do you think is happening around that? And is there perhaps anything that can be done to try and improve this skill within departments? Because when you budget, there are a number of things that the budget does, but what comes out very clear is that if departments just get out of their budgets, for instance, if you look at science and innovation, you've got a 48.9% variance. It's huge, right? So you get my point. Another point I would just like to make, sometimes we're a bit deceiving because everything's reduced to 100, right? But for instance, if you look at 5.4% variance in police, right? It means a whooping 1.3 has been used. So I don't think that we should underplay the question of it was only 5.4%. But if you look at the amount that has been 1.3 billion rand, I'm talking to the question of budgeting skills within the department, perhaps to National Treasury General. Do you think there anything that can be done to try this skill? Because from where we are, we spoke before, we've said that it's very large, and this is the point which was also repeated by Auditor General, that this budgeting thing goes with project management, the code goes with contract management, and looking at these pictures during the first quarter, so that as we move, perhaps we improve on that. National Treasurer, what do you think are the implications generally of this underspending from your perspective? And related to that would be, do your colleagues from the affected departments appreciate the implications of underspending? Another question. Underspending does not result in adverse audit finding. We have said that we think that's an anomaly, because underspending has big implications for service delivery. So if this doesn't result in adverse audit finding, it means the accounting authorities in general and their executives, they can live with this. In any case, when the budget, when the auditors come, it's not an adverse finding. So I want to hear you. I think we as a committee want to recommend the amendment of the legislation so that this results in an adverse audit finding. Your comment. Because what happens, for instance, if you look at I'm just looking at BRASA and RAF. We've got the 14 billion rand underspending, the 11 billion rand underspending. Huge implications in terms of service delivery, let alone other monetary implications, but just on service delivery on its own, we know the state of BRASA. We come here, we sit, we pass budget as parliament, rough the state of our roads, it's bad, but you've got this underspending. But no implication when it comes to audit, it's good, you can stay with the 14 billion rand in the bank account, no consequences. So my question, or perhaps just added to this, I think you know that some of these entities, because of operational expenditure, they are not generating any money or to the desired level because they are not operating. They just take this money, they put it into the bank. This is CAPEX. This is meant for infrastructure. They put the money in the bank. They live on interest. But the opportunity cost in terms of service delivery is just huge. There should be a way of a disincentive as far as that is concerned, because you know the ERRP that the president announced is based on what we do infrastructure. But if we don't spend it on infrastructure, you saw again even in the departments that mainly don't spend on infrastructure. The SOCs, they don't spend on infrastructure. Yet we are saying we wanted to kickstart the economy so that the economy can grow and provide much needed jobs. So I'm just saying there's no disincentive for these entities not to keep money into the bank. But talking about your entities, Dr. Mamfa, can we have a similar bar graph just like you are doing with your government departments to show to show what the trend has been in these different entities, especially I would also like to see it in terms of rent value, how much they've been underspending for the past 5 years. If you can have that graph been sent to us, the same with SOCs, Ravesh, would also like to see something of that nature. For the past 5 years, how much have we recapitalized Eskom with? And again, if you were to be a politician and go and meet with the citizens and you tell them that so much has been spent on Eskom, what did you say the return has been to the citizens? Because that's their money. These are the voters. So it's not parliament. What we are doing, we are channeling this money to Eskom. What would you say the return has been to the citizens? I think the same happens to the SAA and its subsidiaries. I think it was Arabu Sarupen who spoke about Mango. They will come when we recapitalize a company. We are saving, but it's not flying now. We've put in money. So what was that money used for? When I'm saying what was it used for, how did it help a Mango? We just put in money and we put in Mango, and Mango it's on the tarmac, they're not flying. So why did we have to put money into Mango? Then the land bank, I think it's again it's related to what Honorable Sarupen was saying. My question is, I just want to check, what is the incentive for the lenders not to conclude on this matter? Because what I see here, you are having the lenders wanting to guarantee their loans, to secure their loans, which were not secured at the beginning, post factum, right? And I must say that if, from where I'm seated, I don't have all the facts, if we were to do this, then the moral hazard problem creeps in. Where lenders, they are saying, no, we can drag this thing as long as you want. There is no cost to us. That's one. There's no cost to us. But ultimately, you know that the big brother, which is government, will come in here. So I'm just trying to say, what do they hope to achieve with all these things? Because we do it with the land bank, definitely the moral hazard problem is going to creep in. I'm seeing the lenders who want to secure their loans post facto, which is not a good. It may be good to them, but for the bank, that's one. Two, we would also like to hear the report from the minister, because the last time we spoke about this matter, we said we wanted the minister and the executive to be involved in resolving this thing so that finally to one way or the other. It can't be hanging all the time. And then a related question is, is the land bank continuing to give out loans to the farmers in general and to the emerging farmers in particular? Yeah, I think those will be my questions, and Dr. Mampo will do it this the same way with your team. Let's have answers from your side. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Honorable Chair and members. I think we'll take the state-owned companies questions first. I think, Chair, just to your first question around just some of the underspending in SOCs, I think we will note that, and we will we will also I suppose provide an update at the next quarterly briefing. I think Honorable Chair and Honorable members, I think there were questions around some of the conditions that were attached to the allocations, like for the likes of Eskom, Mango, and so forth. I think what we can do as well at a future sitting, to SCOA, we can also provide a detailed briefing in terms of those conditions, because those are quite detailed, and I don't think we have the time to go through it here, but we do have that information which we can go through in terms of compliance to the appropriation conditions as well. I think in terms of the questions themselves, I'm going to ask firstly Lefenze just to come in on land bank, Jeff on Eskom, and then part two on some of the SAA airships and Mango questions. So if I can just ask Lefenze to come in on land bank first, and then Jeff, and then part two. Thanks, Honorable Chair members.
Thanks, Ravesh. I'm switching on my video again, thinking this time it will show.
Listen,
Chair.
Before you come in, there's an oral member who has been kicked out by the Zoom. So as a result, she has written questions, and I would like to raise them for your consideration. If you can just bear with me.
Okay. Chair.
Yeah. It's Honorable Peters who was on the platform, but now and the questions she wanted to raise. So I'll try and read verbatim. She says, Simi National Treasurer and DPE don't treat SAA Mango and SAA Express the same way. So then she asks, she makes that comment, and she says, what is the latest with respect to South African Express? Okay. And then a related question is, why is National Treasury and DPE so accommodating of Eskom? No hardline approach to this entity, which is literally failing South African public year in and year out. She says, Eskom seems to be another government parallel to the one led by His Excellency President Ramaphosa. what conditions do National Treasury put on PPE to ensure proper oversight and delivery at ESCOM? This one is, directed to Rick. Why is provincial and local governments giving the public different information with respect to the disaster funds for case at Eastern Cape floods? She says, what is the latest information with respect to the 2019 disaster funds? Why not ensure that the disaster funds flow to the affected communities? Our people cannot live in homes for such long periods. What about private and possible disease infestation, e.g. cholera and other communicable diseases? Why is National Treasury not engaging the multiple NGOs and other agencies to assist in rebuilding and restoring the lives of our people? So those are the added questions coming from Honorable Tipuo Peters. Continue, Mr. Fenton.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much. The question of Honorable Sarupen, what would be the consequence of the creditors not being paid? Honorable member, I think what we're trying to do is to avoid a situation where lenders would not be paid. And the discussions has always been in that spirit that every lender should be able to get them his money back. Remember the lending by the lenders is to the land bank, not necessarily to government. So government doesn't necessarily own the lenders. The only people that lend a government is committed to and basically is bound to pay is those who are guaranteed. And the total amount of the guarantee is 1.3 billion out of the entire a debt book, of which it's estimated at about 28 billion now. So the only claim that the lenders can make is from the land bank. And what we've been trying to do is that we can try to negotiate with the lenders to basically restructure their debt so that they'll all be paid, although they will not be paid in time. So I will not know what would be the consequence. Obviously, it's going to affect the economy because then land bank has actually failed on paying debt. But the issue is that all of us want lenders to be paid, repaid. And I suppose that's what the lenders, hence they up to this stage, they have not actually called on the debt. The point of the liquidation, liquidation, if remember the Land Bank Act basically does not actually allow the land bank to be liquidated through directly by the lenders, unless if they can do it, obviously. I think so. I'm not the legal expert in this matter, unless if they can do it so through the courts. But either way, if they liquidate, there's a bigger chance that they're going to make far bigger losses than they can actually make through a more structured process of settling the lending problem. So, and I'm sure the lenders have actually made that calculation on their own, that there's a bigger chance that they'll actually, because the only thing that is going to be at risk here would be the assets of the lending. The 7 billion that has been supposed to be allocated to the land bank, it's still with government, so it's not land bank's money as yet. And therefore, it's not going to be part of that money that is going to be actually liquidated. And as such, you can only actually liquidate the assets of the land bank, not anything that is not in the bank of the land bank. And there's a bigger chance that they're going to make bigger losses. So we would not want to see them going through that route. And I don't think they also want to go that route. Hence, they opted for negotiation. However, we also believe that at some point this negotiation must come to an end. We've been negotiating for over 2.5 years, and we're not yet reaching some form of agreement. But that, and I think what lenders want to hear is just assurance that in the event that land bank doesn't want to pay, is not able to pay, then government will pay. Minister has actually indicated in the past that he's fully behind the land bank. Government is fully behind the land bank, and they'll support land bank throughout. What you want to see is to is the land bank that is sustainable, that is able to do business, and that will be able to have sufficient cash and so generate enough money to be able to pay all lenders when money is actually due. Thanks, honorable member. And then going to the chair's question. I will not understand, Chair, with regards to what would be the incentive for the lenders. But I think the only incentive that lenders are holding is not to make any losses. And they know that if they can actually stop that the process now of negotiation, they are likely to have more losses, bigger losses than if they continue the negotiations. That can be the only reason why they've not actually called. Because if they call, then it means the only thing that you can actually back yourself with are the assets of the land bank, not necessarily government guarantee, because they're not guaranteed. Only guarantees lenders would actually be able to call in a guarantee. And they have not called, they don't have a reason to call, because land bank has not failed to pay them every time there's a repayment, whether the servicing of a debt or interest is due. Land bank has been able to meet that. Therefore, for them, there's no reason for a call. They can call because, remember, if you look at how it happened in the first, so because of the cross default, land bank has actually defaulted. And this lenders, the World Bank, then African Development Bank, actually call now if they want to. But, and obviously that is where they come and will actually come in and be able to pay that. How much is this? Yes, Seche, you are right. We need to be very careful how we play this, because it may actually cause or basically bring in a moral hazard. We have delayed this process, and at some point it needs to be concluded. And then the longer we take it, the more we incentivize anyone who is actually owned by one of your associates. For example, if we decide to that government decide to take over the debt of land bank, for example, now, what are we saying to all lenders that are owed by SAA, what are we saying to all lenders that are owed by any other ESCOM or any other? We are actually saying land bank government can actually assume the debt, especially those who are not guaranteed. And we should be very careful that we don't set a precedent that will actually cause trouble for us in the future. The minister's position has always been, please find, well, what is the best way to resolve this issue. And I think, although the minister has not actually made a statement to say what is the next thing that he will want to do, but he has always pushed us to actually find a way of actually concluding this liability solution. And his statement has always been around, try to make sure that you make everyone happier. We want the land bank that is sustainable. We want the lenders that will be happy that they'll be repaid. We want the national treasury that will not be at the risk of finding itself paying. Or then he would want to take in the event that we fail to meet the 30th of September deadline. I don't know. But I think the minister would actually pronounce. We still have to actually discuss with him as sometimes this month, so that he can give us guidance what next to do now. If we see that the signs are saying this matter is not going to be concluded by the end of this month. Is the land bank continuing to give farmers loans? No, Chair. It's not. It doesn't have money to do that. The mine, remember, like I said, technically the land bank is owned by the debt book of land bank is owned, and the loan book of land bank are owned by the farmers. So whatever money that land bank needs to give to the farmers, they need to get permission from the lenders. And it's the lenders who must give the kind of permission. They've actually agreed that they would allow land bank to utilize the 500 million of the total amount of 7 billion if they receive, the land bank receives it for lending. I am not sure whether this is the right thing to do. But the question is, how best can we make sure that one, land bank continues lending, and two, the lender does continue to be paid every time the debt and the service and the interest repayments are due. Thanks, Chair.
Honorable Chair, In regards to Eskom, the question raised by Honorable Supreme is, I think, to a large extent, Ravesh dealt with it, that the details of the conditions, you can make them available. But just to give a high-level overview, that it is segregated into your financial section, where we're looking at the cash flows of Eskom, that the debt is purely dispersed towards meeting the capex, the capital, as well as the interest of the debt, and also that Eskom gives us regular, they will sit with them on a weekly basis, they give us regular their liquidity schedule, so that we understand what their cash flows look like, so that they are able to then meet their obligations. So this is what we're looking at in terms of compliance. They do meet the conditions compliance. However, as we've indicated, that the performance is the challenge that we're facing, where Eskom's plants are failing regularly, hence we're experiencing load shedding. And to Honorable Kaiso's comment around redoubling our efforts, we are hopeful that the initiatives and the interventions that were announced by the President on the 25th of July will go a long way in assisting in ensuring that we do improve our energy availability factor, as well as ensuring that that reduces load shedding, as well as reduces Eskom spending on the diesel side. Those interventions are meant to assist in turning around the electricity crisis that we're facing. Hence, there are various interventions that are being looked at. The team is actually making progress in implementing some of those interventions that are quite short-term and are geared towards improving the energy availability factor. To your point, Chair, around what you've given Eskom so far in terms of the allocations over the shorter period, so far, as we've indicated in the presentation, there's been 140 billion that has been dispersed to Eskom or out of the 230. As to your question around the return that you've gained so far, I would not actually say you've gained anything, except to manage, because this is purely managing Eskom's ability to meet its obligations. We've just done that to meet manage Eskom's obligations in terms of repaying their debt and interest that is due to the lenders. But in terms of performance, as I say, they are still worse off. To Honorable Peter's question around the hard stance, we do take hard stance to Eskom in terms of compliance. We do withhold the disbursement. However, we must also be cognizant of the fact that these have also are quite sensitive, that if you withhold and Eskom is unable to pay, that then exposes the fiscals due to Eskom's exposure. So there's a fine line in terms of how far we can go. We'll try to push them as much as possible to implement efficiencies within the business. They are trying to actually manage that and then meet our requirements, but in terms of withholding the disbursement to them to meet their obligations, there is a risk in terms of withholding them, as Eskom might not be able to then repay their lenders, and that would then trigger an acceleration by the lenders, which would then come back again to the fiscals and expose us to the entire debt book that they have. I think that will be all, Chairperson. Thank you.
Good morning, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. I will cover the questions on SAA-related entities. Firstly, on SA Technical and AHFs, we did provide an update on the performance in our presentation, but unlike Mango, both of these entities are currently operational, servicing both their holding company, which is SAA, the main carrier airline, and some other customers in the market. But both entities have had to be quite dynamic in broadening their customer base, given the challenges that are currently in the passenger aviation market. In relation to Mango, the funding allocated per the Special Appropriation Act was provided to the airline prior to Mango being placed into business rescue. And this funding was allocated for the purposes of restructuring the airline. So post the funding being allocated,
The airline was then placed into business rescue, and funding that was allocated for restructuring was then utilized for the development of the business rescue plan and the implementation of some of the initiatives which were in the business rescue plan. There's currently ongoing work between the Department of Public Enterprises, Mango's Business Rescue Practitioners, and SAA, which is the holding company of Mango. The outcome of this work will provide some recommendations on the way forward in Mango and the future role of Mango in the SAA group. As the National Treasury, will be able to provide our inputs on the recommendations that are developed in this process or once this work has been completed. Ravesh did say we will provide some detailed presentations on the conditions attached to the funding that was allocated, but broadly, the main themes around which the conditions were focused around was that the funding should be used for the restructuring of the subsidiaries, that there should be a reduction on the reliance on government guarantees, and that there should be monthly updates in relation to financial performance, financial position, etc., to ensure that we have sustainability going forward. Chairperson, you asked the question around the funding that's been allocated to SAA over the past 5 years. So since June 2017, there's been a total from June. So I'll provide the update in terms of the funding that was allocated pre-business rescue. So that is June 2017 to December 2019. And that was an amount of 20.5 billion. And this was for a combination of the settlement of government guaranteed debt and the provision of working capital due to the losses that were being incurred by the airline during that period. Post-business rescue is the 10.5 billion business rescue funding that was provided and funding that was provided for the settlement of legacy government guaranteed debt, which was of 16.4 billion. So over the 5 year period from June 2017 to date, there's been a total of 47.4 billion that has been allocated to SAA. In terms of SAA Express, SAA Express was placed under business rescue in February 2020. Unfortunately, the business rescue process of SAA Express failed, and the business rescue practitioners applied to the court to place the airline under liquidation. All government guaranteed obligations of SAA Express have been settled to date. So currently, as we sit, there is no contingent liability exposure that the government has to SAA Express. The latest information that we have is that the liquidators slash the business rescue practitioners of SAA Express are considering some proposals regarding either the sale of the airline or the sale of some of its assets to recoup some value for creditors. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Tim. I think over to Mampo and Tim, Honourable Chair. Thank you.
Thanks, Navish. Good morning, Chair and colleagues. I will answer the questions on higher education and basic education's underspending on the infrastructure. But just as an overall comment, Chair, infrastructure delivery is somewhat more complicated than, let's say, the payment of public service salaries, yeah? So from that point of view, we expect it to not run in the same kind of way. But the point I've taken, it is not acceptable, especially in higher education and basic education, where the backlogs of infrastructure are so great. You would have heard the departments would say they need more money to fix schools' backlogs, to fix pit latrines, etc. But the money that they have is not getting out of the door fast enough. For higher education, I think it was Honorable Matafa that asked about the use of DPWI. They don't use DPWI, and that funding for infrastructure is not for student accommodation. Student accommodation is funded via the student housing infrastructure program, which is run through the DBSA. So that infrastructure spending that has not been spent there relates to university lecture theatres and so forth and so on, and TVET College workshops, etc. So the department transfers money directly to the higher education institutions, and they rely on those institutions to provide them with the business plan, with the procurement details and the cash flow. And so maybe they are not in a position to deal with those matters because they're not infrastructure departments. So from the Department of Higher Education and Training side, they've realized this, and so they are building their capacity in that infrastructure space. And the way that it works, Chair and Honorable Members, is we get a projection from the department at the beginning of the year. We ask them a series of questions. But at the end of the day, Chair and Honorable Members, it is the accounting officer of that department's responsibility to spend the money as they say they would. And so from my point of view, if I've asked you and you say, no, I expect to do this, I have to accept your bona fides in that regard, because you are accounting for that funds. It is not going to be me that must account for the use of those funds, because I'm not the accounting officer. But be that as it may, Chair, from the Department of Higher Education and Training side, as I've just said, they relied on the institutions to provide them with the business plans in the way that they had formulated. They didn't get those business plans, and therefore it was a good thing that they didn't transfer the money, because then the money would just lie on the university's bank balance and at the TVET College's bank balance. So it is not a good thing that it's not being spent, but it's better than that the money is at the department and not at those institutions. For the Department of Basic Education, Chair, you will recall last financial year they spent all their funds. And in fact, the spending had ramped up quite a bit and they were going along at full steam. So their expectation was that the claims from the implementing agents would come in soon after March. And that is why they put money in the first quarter for spending on the school's backlog grant. But the claims didn't come in. So similarly, Chair, I think I've explained this before, they get the claim from the implementing agent, then they have to go out and verify that the infrastructure has indeed taken place as said. They check that everything is in order and then they only pay. So there's a little bit of a longer loop there. And unfortunately, the claims didn't come in and hence their underspending. So to the Honourable Kaiso's question about the department putting in their new regulations that have taken out the deadlines for the school infrastructure norms and standards to be met. From my point of view, and this is just my personal view, I would agree with you that you need to put a hard deadline. Otherwise, it just means we will continue to have schools made of inappropriate materials, etc. But I think, Chair, the problem there is that the department will then require a lot more funding in order to meet those norms and standards. And so on the one hand, there isn't that amount of money available, and on the other hand, the need is so great. And so it's trying to match those two things. The Department of Basic Education has sufficient capacity, as do the provinces. Our Intergovernmental Relations Unit has done a lot of work over a number of years to build the capacity of education departments in the provinces to run and manage infrastructure projects. And as I said, higher education is starting to build that capacity now. They also use the DBSA and other implementing agents, but they haven't yet used, they don't use DPWI. So I think that's me, Mampo. And thank you.
Rendani?
Mampo.
And you?
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair, and members. To the question of Department of Agriculture, Land Reform and Rural Development. Honorable Chair, we have noted the huge understanding in the department, particularly on Program 3. There was a 57.9, a huge understanding, and one of the reasons for such a huge understanding came from the transfers and subsidies under restitution as a result of disputes between the landowners and the claimants regarding the amounts offered. But secondly, on the issue of transfers and to provinces around conditional grants, the issue is that provinces are supposed to submit business plans to the department. So what is happening currently is that the business plans have been submitted and the department legal unit is reviewing those business plans in terms of making sure that the business plans and the MOA all are in order. And once that process has been concluded, they will be taken to the accounting officers for approval, therefore the money will flow. But what we've emphasized to the department is that that process is supposed to actually happen in the first quarter of the previous cycle, so that in the new coming year, first quarter, the money can flow as soon as possible and not to sort of, you know, slow implementation. So this is something that we're trying to push with the department so that we don't delay implementation, and that the planning, you know, in our view, must plan, you know, prior and not in the implementation month. And Chairperson, on the issue of science and innovation, there are three programs that have really underspent. We've got administration with 26%, we've got which is program one, and we've got program two, technology innovation, which is 20.7%, and we've got program five, which is 28.8%. So those are the huge underspending. Chair, I agree with you and respectable members. In program one, it was on goods and services. The issue is the traveling of the minister, domestic and international, you know, which has not happened, like we saw in quarter one, including for the officials, key officials in the department who are supposed to go out there and do their project work. So the issue of travel, you know, has been, you know, a bit slow in the department. Hence, you know, we see that translation. In on program two, Chair, the department is working with various universities, you know, towards its technology support services. So what has happened is that the department, together with these universities, are finalizing the contract. And once those contracts, you know, have been finalized, the money will flow. But like we have advised to Darat, same to DSI, was saying that but come the following month, you know, of the financial year, you are able to fast track or kickstart with implementation. And on program five, Chairperson, again, the issue was with the business plans that, you know, delayed into the finalization. So we are saying that if you get quarter one of the new financial year, the trend or the there seems to be a same pattern in terms of the issue being, you know, the business plans that, you know, our departments are finalizing in the actual, you know, period of implementation. And our advice to them is that you need to do that prior to the implementation period. The sales level agreement, the contracts, the MOA, including the implementation plans or the business plans, that needs to be finalized or concluded prior to implementation year. And going to the issue of EPWP Chair, the grants by the DPWI, the issue there also has been the implementing agencies who have not been able to finalize
the business plan prior. So that has been the cause of the delay by the DPWI not being able to fast track implementation on EPWP projects. You look at particularly the social sector incentive grant and the integrated incentive grant. The planning process there in terms of service level agreement has been delaying. And particularly on the integrated incentive grant, what is happening in that aspect is that spending is expected to normally pick up in the second quarter, mainly because the municipalities with large allocations begin implementation mainly in second quarter, which is the beginning of the financial year. So that is that, you know, whole issue around DPWI. But if you look at the disbursements by DPWI, you will notice that it ranges between 91% and 100% for the past few years. So also, I think the issue of alignment between the financial year of the municipalities with the financial year of the national departments is an issue that, you know, is causing this whole gap in terms of implementation. That is all from my side, Chair. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Chairperson and honorable members and colleagues. It's Randani here. I will deal with some of the questions raised, starting with a question raised by honorable Matafa on BMA. What is the proposed funding model? Are there any engagements between NT and BMA? The funding model is in terms of Section 22 of the Border Management Authority. In the main, it's appropriation. That section talks about appropriation and government grants and any other money that can be appropriated in terms of the Treasury Regulations, Instructions, or PFMA. But in short, there's no any other way to fund the BMA. It's through appropriation. What's happening currently is that we are working with them, the BMA, there are work streams, one of which is the finance work stream. We are constantly in touch. Currently, we are busy with the function shift because BMA is just amalgamation of those functions which are lying all over government departments like Department of Agriculture, Health, Home Affairs. So we are grappling with the issues of function shift. For example, we've got another meeting on the 5th of September together with the police in dealing with these issues. But the long and short of it, we are working closely with them in terms of crafting that path that will get them to be a standalone entity. And there are questions raised by the chair. Implications of underspending and how can we deal with it? I think this question is similar, it's almost the same question which was raised in one of the sessions. I think it was Honorable Peters or Honorable Dikgale, where a proposal was made that why don't we punish underspending? Yes, underspending, not all underspending is bad. I don't want to sound as controversial. In the sense that you've got instances where a department fully spend its budget but doesn't fully meet its targets, or a department that underspend its budget and fully meet its target. I think in the first year of COVID, we came here and we presented an underspending in the Department of Police. I think it was 3 or 4 billion. It was mainly as a result of some efficiencies within the Department of Police. So we must be careful of punishing underspending because we are likely to kill innovation and creativity. And again, the implications thereof of underspending, it depends, like Julia indicated. For example, police, they've got an underspending now of 100 million, almost 100 million, I think 98 point something million. On buildings and other fixed structures. This is mainly for the building and construction of police stations, which are delivered by public works. So what it means that if those projects were about maintenance or the actual building of a police station, it means that we have delayed and that police stations won't be delivered on time. And obviously because of cost escalations won't be delivered on budget. And if it's about maintenance, it means that by the time we have to kickstart that project, instead of doing maintenance, we'll be doing maybe rehabilitation, which will be very much costly. And then the percentages are deceiving. Yes, I agree with Chair, percentages are deceiving, but they are, I think there's a base effect here. You will remember, I think in one of the meetings I presented an a vacancy rate in police in one of the sessions, I think of 2% or 2.4%. And on an establishment of 182,000, that's sort of insignificant. But that 2.4% on its own in terms of absolute figures, you don't have national treasure almost five times. And again, if you check on an establishment like that one of police, and especially taking into account that they recruit the constables by taking them to colleges for, I think, 8 months. That's why if you plot personnel numbers in police, if you plot them monthly, you will see the numbers going down because they don't do intakes monthly. They do them usually in February, March. So during the course of the year, you'll see the numbers going down, and obviously also the vacancy rate will be going up. But at some point, now there's going to be an absorption of the trainees. I'm not spending this slide responding. Yes, I think I've dealt with the question that I had to deal with. Over to you, colleagues. Thanks, Chair.
Okay, Chair, let me answer my set of questions. So maybe just a general one around conditional grants. I think the first thing that's quite important to understand, to remember about conditional grants, is that they are conditional. So we set conditions in terms of the Division of Revenue Act. So when national transferring officers have to transfer funds, these funds have to be compliant with provisions that is set out not only in the Act itself, but also in the grant framework. And because of that, so any delays that come on the back of transfers or on the back of a business plan that isn't approved, then suggests that if a department or a transferring officer breaches those conditions that is set out in the grant, it may be deemed irregular expenditure. Then just in thinking, in response, responding to the specific issue to infrastructure spending is slightly different because it comes at the time of implementing something that is under uncertain conditions. So it doesn't matter how many geotechnical tests you do, once you hit the ground and there's something unexpected in there, you get site stoppages. But there's also a whole range of other reasons that we're seeing in why we have delays in the implementation of some projects. And this would relate to contractual disputes that might pop up. I don't think we underestimate this issue around a construction mafia and the interpretation around the local economic development components that we have in our procurement regulations that's been resolved in site stoppages or labor disputes that result in site stoppages. That first needs to be resolved. So there's lots of these kind of unplanned issues that seem to pop up that you don't necessarily contract for in relation to how then we deliver on our infrastructure programs. And a lot of that then resolves in these kind of untimely delays that we then see within the budgets of water and sanitation. And then just on the disasters, to answer Honorable Mizana's question around what informs the allocations that we make, So the disaster response funding that we have in the budget is on four conditional grants that makes up the famous billion rand that we talk about. Those conditions, I mean, the emergency housing grant has very specific conditions, and so does the disaster response grant on the votes of DCOC and on the votes of human settlements. And these grants then mean that, so for in the case of the disaster response grants with DCOC, a whole set of verifications have to be done and assessments have to be done to ensure that the infrastructure that is damaged is as a result of the disaster and not because of poor maintenance or some other issue that a municipality or a province may have. There's further conditions around how that money must be spent. So the immediate response grant, for example, must be spent within 6 months of the first transfer, because if you're spending anything beyond 6 months, then it's no longer immediate. In the human settlements case, we're also looking at kind of the temporary relocation units that was being provided and the assistance that is provided with that, and checking whether this is actually for houses that was damaged in the same way that we have with the infrastructure. There are issues that we then check in relation to where people come from, where they do they qualify for a subsidy, and what so that you can determine whether you need to be doing things in a way that you're kind of providing a full temporary relocation assistance or whether you're providing repairs to housing structures. Just in relation to the question from Honorable Peters on disasters and using NGOs and communities, each of our disasters, so the disaster response framework requires that each, or the Disaster Management Act requires that each organ of state has a disaster management framework. And how that framework gets implemented, so each kind of program and each accounting officer can determine how it wants to implement its disaster response. So in the case of these floods, if a municipality or a transferring officer, even a national department, wanted to use an NGO to do specific work, that is up to them to decide. It's not up to the Treasury to decide. The decision-making around all of this isn't centralized, it's decentralized, and it means that all of those program managers who then decide on how best to implement the response would then have to be held accountable for that. I think that's all for my side. Thanks.
Good morning, and honorable members.
Who's that? We can't hear you.
It's Mokata Jefferson. Mokata, please speak closer to the mic.
Okay. Yes, I was saying I'm going to take two questions, one on AGSA and the other on SPESSA. There was a question around whether the National Treasury has a relationship with the AGSA and whether we are providing financial support, especially for auditees that are struggling financially. And the answer to the two questions is yes. We do have a relationship with the AGSA, and part of the support the financial we are providing is in the form of a 70 million per year over the medium term to assist auditees that are struggling financially. And in terms of SSA, I think the question was around when the results of the census would be released after the number of postponements that we've all witnessed. The census, the collection of the data was concluded in May, end of May this year. And currently the department is busy with data coding. They will also do an analysis and interpretation of the data before they compile the report. And from indications that we have received from the department is that the report itself will be released next year in May. Thank you.
Chairperson, I'm just going to deal with the rest of the questions. Honorable Mlenzani, I just want to
I assure you that we are not hiding anything from the committee. I think what we will have to do in the next round is just to take the committee through the PFMA, the roles and responsibilities of the different role players and the accounting authorities. Problem with the honourable members, as a DDG of public finance, I can't go and say to a DG of a department, you are not spending, therefore I'm going to, you know, take action. I mean, I can't do that. The PFMA clarifies the different roles. So it's mainly how does Parliament hold accounting officers responsible for what they need to deliver. I mean, it's not shifting the responsibility from the Treasury, but we are allowed to do specific things, but Cabinet also is responsible for doing other things. Ministers are responsible for doing other things. Parliament has also responsibilities. So I think the key would be how do we as role players together help the departments achieve what they need to achieve. There's also, Chairperson, the issue of the skills and understanding the processes. I mean, with the disaster funds and the manner in which there were such negative media statements or media commentary is precisely because at some point there was a misunderstanding on how processes work. So I think we as Treasury need to continue to assist departments to understand how processes work, but at the end it is their responsibility to make sure that they deliver on what they're supposed to deliver on. So the issue of budgeting skills, Chairperson, you have raised it a couple of times. You have been insisting that we need to understand whether the state is capable of executing this, and from the understanding, one needs to think about ways in which we can capacitate the departments. I mean, we can. The National School of Government is one entity that we can start talking to in order for them to shape the courses that they do to help the departments with some of the budgeting skills that might be required. But also, Chairperson, I think the onus is on the accounting officer to employ people who are capable and understand the government processes so that we avoid a situation where people who are placed in positions don't understand the work that they need to do. But this is a key problem, Chairperson, that we face. Even in Treasury, in my division, to appoint people who have the right skills, who have the right qualifications, takes time because you have to be extra careful not to just take people who won't at the end be able to deliver. So to find the right people for the right position is also another problem that we're facing as the state. But I agree with you that, you know, we need to think broader. And we are very clear on the roles of the Treasury and the PFMA, and most of the departments, of course, they adhere to that. But even then, you still find some of these underspending issues that crop up in some of their spending. But I agree that we might have to think about how do we capacitate the state in order to be able to deliver. But Chairperson, the conversation of capacitating the state has to be broader than just looking at bringing people into the system. We also have to think about how do we change the system or the elements of the system that are no longer working. How do we consolidate entities where there's duplications of functions? How do we look at the state in its entirety and then have a plan of what type of government do we want to see? And then from there, we start working towards getting to that level or to that government that we want to see that is capable of delivering its mandate. So it's a combination of looking at the right skill set, but also What is it that is no longer working, no longer fit for purpose? What can we close? What can we consolidate? And then from there, Chairperson, I think we can move towards a space where we have a government that we think is capable of implementing and delivering services. The issue of IFMS, Chairperson, I think I must ask the committee to request the accounting officer of the National Treasury to come and deal with the IFMS project, because this is more of Momo's responsibility to respond to, especially with the issues of who has been held accountable for this, what step have they taken, and he as the accounting authority should be able to do this. Chairperson, your request for graphs for the understanding for the entities, we will definitely do, and then we will share the data with the secretariat. Thank you so much, Chairperson.
Thank you, Dr. Mampo, and your team again for responding to the issues that have been raised by the honourable members. I think before I let you go, Honourable Nkwankwa sent me a question which he asked me to put to you. He can't put it himself, and I think I must. I'm sure you remember that Honourable Nkwankwa has been raised the question of the recipients of SASRIA generally, but here in particular he's saying how efficient have been the bailouts of SASRIA in KZN. If you could respond to that person with SASRIA, that is following the unrest, July unrest that we always talk about. Yeah, I think they can you have that response before I proceed?
Okay, honorable members, please just give me a chance just to switch on my camera.
Thank you.
You can see me?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. So when it comes to SASRIA, so SASRIA has been efficient in settling the claims in a sense that at this stage it's now 80% of the claims that have been paid out, and then that have been paid out with respect to the July unrest. So as I explained earlier on, is that the claims that have not been paid, those are the claims that relate to customers or claimants or SASRIA clients that still need to forward the information through to SASRIA. I would just like to check if the honourable member is answered.
Yeah, I think so. That's fine. I think so.
Okay. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Okay, as we conclude from our side, just make a few comments on the responses that have been made. Julia, we agree with you when you say that infrastructure projects are complicated, and I think you are correct. All that I want to say is that what we are using to evaluate performance, as it were, are the very same budgets which were put by the departments. It's not as so. These things, all the other variables, would imagine that those things have been factored in when people present a budget to you as National Treasury, and then to us as Parliament, and to approve is based on the professionals who have come together and put that budget. So whenever we
we evaluate. It's not us who would have put up those budgets, but it's their department. It's not you with National Treasury who would have put up those budgets. It's those departments, the accounting officers and authorities. So my take generally is that let's not be too willing to accept explanations. Dr. Mampo, I also hear you when you say what you can do as National Treasurer and what you can do is contained within the legislation. But sometimes when we make these inputs, we are dealing with the messenger, because amongst others, as such, we are telling us that's what is happening. So we'd also like you to go back and take the inputs coming from the honorable members back to the people responsible, but most importantly, to the accounting authorities, accounting officers, to the minister. That these are the issues that we are raising. We are here in Parliament. We take it that we employ the best of the best to deal with these things. We don't have capacity to solve these problems on your behalf as part of the executive and part of the administration. We expect solutions from your side. From our side, we just want to say, okay, that's what we've been promised, because that's what we're talking about. We're talking about what Parliament has been promised, what our people have been promised, and then see how far we've gone with that. So the inputs that we'll be making may not necessarily be to you as National Treasurer, but we are saying that as you interact in different fora, that you interact with your colleagues, be they DG or with your minister.
Members.
Hello. Okay, let's just mute. I was just saying, when you make these inputs, our expectation, those things should go back to the people who have given you this information to say these are the issues that have been raised by the committee, by the honorable members in the committee. So you shouldn't interpret them as being a reflection to you and to the to National Treasurer in general, but we're saying that they should go back to the administration and go back to the executives, that as we look at these things, these are the issues that we are confronted with. So share with the responsible people. I also accept that Darren, we should follow up with the acting DG at National Treasury around the IFMS story. You remember that is an area that is an issue that we also raised with the Auditor General when they appeared before us. With those few words, there are a lot of things that when the variance between the budget and the actual was explained to us, more of a timing issue. So we hope to see improvement in the second quarter, Dr. Mampo, on expenditures. Honourable members, I think this takes care of the agenda item of a National Treasury. Thank you very much, colleagues, and good luck. There's also this thing of which I don't know how we solve it. You see, putting yourself in the shoes of the members of the public, then when certain things don't happen, and then we as government come out and we say, no, this has not happened because Department A or Province A or Municipality A didn't comply with our requirements. I think people are not interested in that. People are just dealing with one government. This thing of national, provincial, and local government is something that when they're interacting with government. So the issues which are amongst ourselves as government, I think we should always find a way of resolving. There are lots of conditional grants which can't go ahead because
province hasn't done this and so on. My understanding is that we are one government. That's what we are, and we should find fora where we are able to iron out whatever problems are. I remember at one stage I suggested to one minister and said, why don't you old guys get into the one room, what National Treasury wants, what you must do, and so on, you do it, and you don't get out of that room before that happens. So that at the end of the day, our people are not held into ransom by our own processes. They are having us there. They want us to solve their problems. They don't want us to come to them and say, this is the problem with this lack of government or with this department and so on. So the silo approach in terms of solving our problems, it's something that we really need to deal with. But do those words, please, that's your part, Goss. Thank you very much. Hope to see you in the not too distant future. Dr. Mampo, Sigbonani, food when I'm coming back. You're a regular here.
With the next quarter, Chairperson, but also with the MTBPS, the adjusted appropriation bill. So you'll be seeing me more often now.
Okay. Thank you so much, colleague Team Treasury. Thank you so much. Let's proceed, honourable members. Darren, do we have any announcements?
Chairperson, no, not really. It's just a reminder about tomorrow's meeting with the OCPO. It will start at 9 o'clock. I'm going to send the link immediately after the we've adjourned this meeting.
Thank you, Darren. Let me take this opportunity to thank the honorable members on the platform, our support staff, and everybody who was on the platform for being part of this meeting. The matter that we're dealing with, especially around spending and in particular underspending, I think it is an issue that should continue to bother us. Thank you so much. This brings us to the end of the meeting, and the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, colleagues.
Thank you, Chair. Are
you there? Thank you. Thank you, Masilian. Let's try to have minutes by tomorrow so that we don't have them piling up.
Yes, Chair. Let's speak on the Sadal call you. No.
Perfect. Right.